Good morning, everyone. Oh, geez. Okay. It's like I'm going to sing karaoke or something. Hold on. Okay. Thank you. Sorry. Yeah. Okay. I'm short, so I never have to move the mic up because I'm so short. But anyway, okay. Well, good morning, everyone. I'm honored and so humbled to be here. When I got the call for this, to do this talk, I had to check with Lisa that she had the right person. Like, are you sure? Like Nancy R. from Glendale? Okay. And then, in my mind, I just thought, I'm sure there's somebody more recovery, better speaker. You know, just my immediate default is, I'm not worthy. You know, why are you asking me? And I'm sharing that because, I think it I can forget about my recovery and take it for granted, but that was my default. You know how they talk about when we learn something new or repeat a behavior, new ideas and behaviors create a groove in our brain, and it deepens the more we do it. I really think that probably one of the deepest grooves in my brain is you're worthless, because that's just the thought that I probably have had most of my life in my head, So, and I'm 61, and I just have come back recently again into recovery. And so probably for the last 5 years, it's still my default, though, because even on the phone call, I was thinking that. But I don't have to stay there. And so that's the recovery, and I'm just so grateful for that. So that's why I wanted to share that, just that, we're still who we are. We bring our whole selves to this process, and it's not that stuff disappears, but it lessens and it gets better, and that's something to be grateful for. So I really am grateful and humbled to be here. So thank you for that. That whole process that I just described there also reminds me of that principle that I'm not responsible for the first thought, but I am responsible for the second thought and the actions following that. So that's an important thing. That's been an important principle for me to think about in recovery. And then I just wanted to say something, too, about my talk title, which is OA is My Refuge. So we finished the call, and I thought about it and talked to my sponsor and agreed to do this talk. And then a few weeks later, I got a text, what's your talk title? So I'm like, oh, no. Like, now it's real. Now it's, I got to actually do something. And I happened to be in Florida with my sister and her partner at the time, and I'm very grateful because we have recovery in our family. So those two are not candidates for a 12-step program as far as I know, but they're familiar with it. It's a discussion in our family. So anyway, we were kicking around the idea the whole 4 days I was there. We were in St. Augustine, and it was just a nice thing to have in recovery. And they're outsiders, so they're lobbying suggested titles that make no sense. But anyway, I considered every option, and I was sitting at the beach one day and just thought, where do I feel safe and protected and, free from harm? Where is my refuge? And it's here. It's literally right here, right now. So I just want to thank you for being here, because every meeting is a refuge. It's an hour that I am free from eating. I'm free from sometimes I'm free from my crazy thinking, So a refuge is a condition of being safe or sheltered from pursuit, danger, or trouble. Our addiction pursues us, it's dangerous, and it gets me into a lot of trouble. It's a refuge is something that provides shelter from all that, and it provides protection and safety. So what it was like for me was that I thought food was my shelter for my whole life until I came to OA. So I'm fifth of six kids, fourth of five daughters. And so there was never any fighting among sisters, as you can imagine. So anyway, my dad kind of joked for a while that he said for about a decade there when the girls were teenagers, I just didn't say a word, So I always thought his wisdom was something I could emulate at times. So I just, I think a lot of kids are, God love the birthday cake, the birthday because of the sweets there, the wedding, the holidays, vacations, family reunions, just the freedom from structure and the unfettered access to food. That's what I loved about my childhood. If you told me, what are your favorite memories? those are them, you know, because I didn't, I could, you know, at the weddings, we'd lift up the heavy tablecloths and go underneath. We had a whole city under there of food and alcohol. I mean, it was awesome. And I was at the younger end of all those cousins, so they were all getting married a couple every summer, and it was great. It was, you know, those are wonderful memories. But then, you know, preteen years, so I think a lot of kids do that. All my cousins were doing it. But, you know, my thinking, though, in those, like, elementary years, you know, my mom would always have a pan of something or a plate of something after school, and I'd come home, and the family room's here and the kitchen's here. So we're watching TV, and I'm always calculating how, you know, how much time has to go by before I can go back for my second serving, you know. And my mom was a compulsive overeater who fortunately found this program before she passed. But she'd go to the grocery store, and she'd put all the sweets in her little hiding places, you know, the deep pot in the back and, you know, just the various places. So those of us who are compulsive overeaters, I knew where all those were. But what time can I go down where it's quiet enough and nobody's around? And how much can I get to show that I haven't really been there? I mean, you know, the insanity and the time that I thought thinking about that and trying to, you know, cover everything up that I was doing. That, I think, was a little atypical for a child. And then moving into my preteen years, my parents were pretty social. On a typical Saturday night, they would be out. My older siblings would be out. And then the three youngers of us would be home. And I would bake to my heart's content. I mean, they'd come home, there would be just mounds of bars and plates of things and pans. And everybody was happy. My parents would come home, my older siblings. And even in our family, I baked enough that it could last us for a day or two, you know. So, but I mean, it was a lot of food, but that was fine. That was kind of a norm in our house. Nobody thought twice about it. If there were five boxes of stuff to be made, I made them all. And then there were five more the next Saturday. So, you know, that was just kind of, that's what happened in our house. Then in my teen years, I got into drugs and drinking. And in my college years, then I found 12-step recovery for those issues. God, thankfully, took away my compulsion in those areas. And now what do I have? Food. So now my food, my eating really takes over because I'm not doing the other addictive behaviors. So anyway, I graduate from college. I'm in a 12-step program. I get my first, you know, kind of professional job, and my days are like this. I wake up, I smoke cigarettes. So I smoke cigarettes and coffee is my breakfast. Cigarettes and Diet Coke is my lunch. I work all day. I go to the gym. I probably would go to a 12-step meeting or something in the evening of that other program, and then I would eat. And I never cooked. I still don't cook. I call myself an assembler. I put things together. I make salads. Anyway, I never cooked. I would just stop on the way home at a drive-thru, at a pizza place. I'd get my packages, I'd get my things. And then I'd go home, and I would just stuff myself, you know. And it was about 30 to 45 seconds in that I'd get the relief, you know, that sense of ease and comfort that we're looking for, that our big book talks about. I'd get it for, you know, 30 to 45 seconds in when I'm stuffing myself. I'd get it for about 5 seconds, and then it's gone. But I'm still eating. You know, and I'd eat until I couldn't eat anymore, and then I would pour dishwashing soap over all of it and toss it because I couldn't trust myself when I stopped feeling stuffed that I wouldn't just keep going, you know. And I can remember times where I was sitting with this like mound of food with dishwashing soap over it, crying, like I don't want to do this. This is my effing life right now. Are you kidding me? You know, but it was. So I hit a bottom. That's what it was like around food. What it was like inside of me, it was hell. I was full of shame. I was so full of conflict. I hated myself. I felt unworthy. I was angry. I was argumentative. I was self-righteous. These are my defaults. These are my grooves, right? You know, when I'm eating, these are my defaults. This is scary. I'm judgmental, I'm critical, I have hair trigger reactions. I remember being in a meeting once and my boss was going to roll out something, some new thing they're doing, and there's about six of us in the meeting, and she goes, she kind of lays out what we're going to do at the meeting, and then she goes, now Nancy, I don't want you to freak out, so just take a deep breath. I mean, so, okay, I'm not, this is for real, unfortunately. I was a rager at my son. I would say yes, but I wanted to say no, and I was seething with resentment, and I would ruminate over those resentments. And, you know, and that, of course, led me to the food. I was negative. I wish things could change. I wish things would change, but I never took any action about to change anything. I blamed others and God for all this. So I stayed in the cycle, and I was pulled further into the abyss. So, you know, descending into that abyss is just, it's just baffling, you know, because it's like, I just told you what I'm like when I'm on sugar. And so who would want to stay there? And yet the payoff is that 5 seconds, that elusive 5 seconds. But everything I do, all the thinking, the planning, the plotting, I spend so much of my mental life figuring out how to get food, how to get access to it, how to get that 5 second, you know, place where I'm, you know, having the ease and comfort that this substance provides me. And then, you know, and then I'm back to the hell of it. And, you know, so who would choose that? You know, and when we're at that point, we have, it tells us in our literature, we have lost the power of choice in drink. So, sorry, I think I marked it. On page 24, the fact is that for most alcoholics, for reasons yet obscure, have lost the power of choice in drink. Our so-called willpower becomes practically non-existent. So, you know, it's the thinking, and then it's the physical malady takes over, and I can't stop it. It's so powerful. I'm just pulled into that abyss. And, you know, whatever embarrassing thing, however, I look in the mirror in the morning, I'm humiliated, but I keep doing it. I don't do anything to change that. You know, that is power. That's the power of our addiction. And in order for us to, you know, we can't overcome that. We need something so much more powerful than us to overcome that addiction. So, I didn't try to access that power. I just stayed in the addiction, and I kept getting pulled in, and it kept me sick and stuff and stuck and shame. Just I lived in shame and self-hate, and they were just kept getting compounded. So what happened is that, you know, I needed a new refuge. And so I knew about the power of a 12-step program. So I went to OA in Arizona for the first time in the 80s. So I went for about a month, lost my 10 pounds, see you later. 10 years later, I'm going to grad school in upstate New York, and I know, I couldn't have said it, I couldn't have articulated it to you, but I knew that I couldn't be successful in grad school and be in my disease. So I had, and ironically or whatever, when I joined OA in Arizona, it was a HOW meeting. When I moved to Syracuse, it was a HOW meeting. And then when I moved here, it was HOW. So I've only ever known HOW for OA. So anyway, 10 years later, I'm in upstate New York, and I you know, consciously just join HOW because I know I need it. And I had a pretty good run there from, like, the late 90s. I finished grad school, moved here for my first job. Same thing here. Couldn't have articulated it, but I knew in this new job for me, I needed abstinence. I couldn't successfully do the job and be eating the way that I had been. So I hung around, you know. And so I was here. I was here in meetings till about 06. And then I left. I came for a minute, maybe in 2010. And then I came back, you know, for this time in 2018. And then weight-wise, every decade, it was just, this disease is so progressive. In the 80s, I had 10 pounds to lose. In the 90s, I had 20. When I came back in 2010, I had 30 pounds to lose. But remember, I had been in program since 06. So that was really only 4 years. And now I've got 30 pounds to lose. And when I came in back in 18, I needed to lose 55 pounds. And I lost about 25 of that kind of right away in the first year or so. And then during COVID, for whatever reason, I think I know the reason, and I think it's that God was saying, you got to work on your relationship with me. I didn't lose any weight, and I was still pretty heavy, but I just spent that year focusing on my emotional and spiritual recovery, and it was the best thing that I could have done. I slowed down. I mean, you know, I know that COVID was very, you know, very tragic and difficult for a lot of people, but there were some silver linings. And I have to say, I think my program really benefited from my forced slowdown, you know. So anyway, and then I lost, and then I did go back to a nutritionist in August of 21 and lost that last 30 pounds. So, or not last, but an additional 30 pounds. So anyway, I came back in fall of 18. Like I said, my mom passed in June of 18. And as I said, she was in OA at one point in her life. And when she passed, because of this program, we were on good terms when she passed. And I'm so grateful for that. And I feel her hand in me being back here, you know, because she passed in June and I came back in fall of 18. Didn't get abstinent till 19, but came in, got a sponsor, and worked the steps. And, you know, just really, I think, you know, every time I come back, you know, it's just, it's diving in again, and I'm in a new place, but I am powerless over this disease. I just am. I hate it. I hate it that I'm powerless, but I am. And I'm just at a new place of accepting that powerlessness and things. So I just wanted to check on my time. Are we? For total?
No.
Oh, okay. Okay, great. Okay, sorry about that. So I wanted to be sure on my pacing. So I came back in fall of 19, like I said, and I worked the steps and, you know, which I had done before. And so, but, you know, the first three steps, just that surrender and sitting in front of all that white sugar and flour with dishwashing soap over it, if that's not powerlessness, what is? Right? So I can't deny it, except I'm a compulsive overeater, so I can, because I'm good at denial. I mean, I'm right here, but I don't know that I'm right here sometimes. You know, the way I can disassociate for myself and justify things is just remarkable to me. I mean, I'm still blowing myself away by that, honestly. You know, it's like, wow, how did I do that? So my sponsor and I worked through the first three steps. I did another fourth and fifth, and you know, worked on the sixth and seventh step, really identifying some of my bigger character defects, one of which is self-righteousness. I mean, the worst place, the absolute worst place for me to be is you know, having like a point, like being kind of right, and the other person, and it being kind of obvious, and the other person not being right, you know, because my self-righteousness, that, and if I'm justified in something, that is a very dangerous place for me to be. And so it's something I'm working on. So we did do the six. I, you know, got in touch really and looked at some of my grosser handicaps, you know, my character defects, and started looking at those and working on those, and did eighth and ninth step. And then I was presented in 2020 with an opportunity to do a daily 10th step, a scripted, structured kind of a daily call. And I was too intimidated to do it when I first heard about it, because I just felt like I didn't want to make that kind of a commitment. But I started doing it in October of 2020. And it's right out of the big book. It's a script, you know, that is, you know, we continue to watch for selfishness, dishonesty, self-seeking, and behaviors, and fear. And so, and there's a lot of this script that we have has a lot of little questions underneath each one to help me think through and, you know, understand how I approach situations and where I'm at fault. So one of the ones let me just say this about the 10 step first, and that is that, you know, every step of it I find really, really helpful. Like I have to, so let's say I've wronged somebody. Let's say I, you know, spoke to somebody harshly at work. I have to think about that. I have to pray about it. You know, and then this process requires that I write about it, that I talk to somebody about it, I share it with them, and that they give me feedback. So every step of that process is really important, and it's been really helpful for me in what I believe is, you know, the goal of this program. So that's 10 or 5. Thank you. So the goal of this program is to help us have a spiritual experience. And so that, our book defines that as a profound alteration in our reaction to life. And so, you know, that means change. And our book talks about, like, the inward reorganization, you know. And this process, this daily 10-step process, has really helped me to do that. And I'll give you a couple of examples. One is And this is just sort of a generic example, but it's the under dishonesty, one of the bullet points is I'm dishonest because I'm saying this is the problem when actually my thinking about that is the problem. So let's say, for example, that my son is leaving his socks around, which that's hypothetical. That never happens. But anyway, okay, so every day socks are there. Okay, so that's I'm resentful at Dylan because he leaves the socks around, doesn't listen to me, yada, yada, yada. Okay, and by the way, that part and on the scripted thing can only be 19 minutes because otherwise you're getting into the story again. I didn't mean 19 minutes. Only 19 minutes, that'd be forever. Only 19 words, that's what I meant to say. So when you describe it, you have to do it in 19 words or less. Otherwise you're going on and you're getting into the resentment, right? So in any case, okay, he's leaving his socks, and so, you know, where's my fault in this, you know? Is it wrong for me to expect that he picks up his socks? No. You know, my job, though, is to stay emotionally balanced. So if I'm calling my partner every day and saying, he left his socks again, he left his socks again, he left his socks again, that's not what it is. It's so the dishonesty in that case, if I were doing that, the issue wouldn't be he left his socks. The issue is that I'm not changing how I think about him leaving his socks. So I could write him a letter, say, please don't do this again. I mean, I've been doing it for 18 years, so it's probably not going to change. What if I accepted that? What if I accepted the fact that he might not pick up his socks? And you know, am I going to sit here and ruminate over it and live a life of anger because he wants to leave his socks on? By the way, this is a person that I love very dearly, but I do have, you can get an app, which is a countdown calendar to any big event in your life. So I have a countdown calendar to my empty nest. And it's 4 months and 4 days from today, I'm just saying. So, you know, so we do, I think, you know, have a good relationship, but it's because of this program, you know. And so I can't, if I'm going to berate him every day, though, because of the socks, that's not going to help me. That's not recovery. So, you know, there are lots of things I can do. And we had a student from Korea living with us for a semester, and his mom suggested everybody gets a day, and on that day, you take everything on the first floor up and just put it outside the door of the other person's room. So there's at least 3 days where I'm not even looking at it. You know? Well, okay, so I'm probably not going to be as mad. I mean, the point is there are lots of things I could do. The way that I lost the power of choice in drink, I lost the power of choice in reacting. I mean, I told you, I was hair trigger reacting. The concept of pausing, when I first read that in the 10th step, I was like, are they joking? I mean, I literally could not fathom it. You know, if you said something and I disagreed with it or I knew you were wrong or whatever, I was going to jump in. I probably wouldn't even wait for you to finish your sentence. That's who I was when I came in this program. And so for, you know, to the profound alteration is happening, but it's only because, you know, this 10 step is really helping me to, like I said, reorganize myself. And I can't sit around and blame other people for things. It's if I don't like it, what am I going to do about it? You know, and so and I do want to share one other thing since I guess I'm glad I have a little time, it seems. So you know, the I do love this person that I'm living with, and I'm going to tell a story now, and I want to just say up front that I don't mean to denigrate him in any way, and you'll see at the end that he comes out, you know, but we're all human. He comes out well at the end. But we had something very recently where the thing that you plug your phone into, okay, there's a cord and a charger. I called the whole thing a charger, okay? So I said, you know, we're having a problem with the charger. Could you fix it? Well, that, you know, apparently my son thinks that the thing that plugs into the wall is the charger. So anyway, we had a humongous blowout over this thing. And, you know, and he is a good kid. It's just right now we're having these kind of flare-ups. And you know, it can be over something this simple. And over something this simple, I mean, our speaker last night, I just want to quote her because she spoke about her son, I believe, turning into the spawn of Satan and having telling her to go off and do unnatural things to herself. So that's the level we were at. And I said, okay, no more of that. But then I'm getting barraged with texts. I'm in the middle of a work day, by the way, when all this is happening. So I'm getting barraged with texts you know, F-bombs, you know, the whole shebang, let's just say. And I'm pausing for once in my life. I call my sponsor. She's in the car with her husband, and she tells me that. You're on speaker. Huh? Well, great. I'm happy for you that you're having a great day. I'm dying over here. And so, and I know her husband well enough to, you know. So they listen, and they tell me everything they needed to. It was wonderful. You know, it was my refuge. I needed, at that moment, I needed refuge, you know. And, I mean, I was worked up, and anyway. And my sponsor is amazing. In this case, her husband came up with kind of the gem, and he helped me to craft, because, you know, my son had, he had burned so many bridges. He had written really mean and bad things, and I thought, you know, it would be hard for him to come back from that. You know, if I had done that, which I've done in my life, and when you are, you know, I say things in the heat of the moment that are so bad and so mean, you can't just come back and be like, sorry, you know. So I said, you know, so when we talked, and this is also the benefit of recovery and the refuge of program people, living the same principles. I mean, we all sort of agreed fairly early in the conversation what was needed is a way back. How are we going to repair this? You know, he's hurting. So, you know, so anyway, so I sent an email something like, I apologize, or I'm sorry that my lack of technology vocabulary created a catalyst for today's unfortunate interaction or something like that. And he had also told me I hadn't listened to him. So I said, you know, I you're right, I hadn't listened to you, so I apologize for that too. The minute I sent that, I got like four texts right back right away. Mom, I'm so sorry. I was so out of line. The language was wrong. You know, the language, what I said to you, all of it. And at the fourth text was, thank you so much for reaching out. I really appreciate that, especially after what I said. So, you know, I'm getting this benefit in my life. And, you know, recovery is generational, and addiction is generational, and so is recovery. And, you know, this program, this step is the way back. I don't know that we have another way. I mean, I don't know of one. But even in the world, is there another way to repair relationships with people other than to go humbly and say, I screwed up. I love you. I want this to work. And, you know, it's okay, you know. Yeah, you just really hurt me, like, big time, I'm sorry to say. Killed me. But you know what? Even that doesn't give me the right to lash out. And I never knew that. Not only did I not know it, I definitely couldn't do it. So, and believe me, I just wanted to share that story because, again, I think it, for me, it illustrates my recovery, and it illustrates the power of what God can do in this program. And again, I didn't mean to throw Dylan under the bus, because again, that's very rare. And he, on his own, he's reconnected with a counselor. So I mean, he's doing what we're doing, not in program, but he has seen a little bit of a model of apologizing. And and you know, when I came back, you know, he was about 13. And so then I've been in this process of, you know, apologizing. I mean, what teenager doesn't want their parent to stand in front of them and say, I was wrong, you were right? So he's had a couple of years of loving this whole thing, but he's been also taking it in because he does it back. And I am so grateful. And I know that God, I know that God's hand is everywhere in this, because that's a gift that he wanted to give to Dylan. Or, you know, that Dylan's higher power wanted him to have going through life. And, you know, right there, that's worth the price of admission. I'm just so grateful for that alone. So it saved our relationship. It's this process is always our way back to each other. And I never knew that. And what a gift we have to know that, you know. And then step 11 is meditation and prayer, conscious contact. You know, I love the word sought through prayer and meditation. For a while in program, and I do have my morning kind of repertoire, you know. I do my prayers. I do my, I don't write every day. I write for the 10-step, but in the morning I don't always write. But I do have quiet time. I've kind of expanded it with adding music. And it's, talk about a refuge. I need that every day. I need to try to create that conscious contact. Because one of the things, and it talks in our book about how, we come to rely on this source of inspiration and power. And I've experienced that. I have relied on this power. And I used to do these things, my morning routine, kind of because I had to, because it was programmed and I didn't want to eat and I wanted to get away from all that other, that other person I had been. And I still want that. I want to get away from that. But it's more now I feel like I'm seeking it, like I'm reaching toward the light. Like I'm not backing away from the pain. I am, but I'm more reaching toward the light because it feels so good, And I've never gotten to that point in my times in OA in my recovery. And then I'll just say about the 12 step, the spiritual awakening, I do feel like I've had a very profound different way of responding to life, the grooves, the old grooves are still deeper than the new grooves. So the only way I'm going to keep at it is by keeping at it, And I'm just, again, so grateful for these, what they call maintenance steps. But I mean, to me that sort of connotes a steady, maintenance. Our growth continues. And all the principles that were true when I first started, just take a little step. That's all you need. That's still true. All I need to do if I want to deepen my recovery is just say, God, what can I do? And then, boom, I go to my Thursday meeting and somebody says, oh, I'm doing these new steps. Do you want them? I'll text them to you. Oh, my gosh. I just asked for that, and they're on my phone, So the other thing, about the 12 step is carrying the message in program. I mean, I try to do service when I can. I'm pretty active in my home group, and I sponsor, and love coming to events like this and workshops that we have around our area. And then practicing the principles in all my affairs, I'll just say that I have the same job that I had when I was eating. And I was a little worried about that coming back. But, I am absolutely the person they talk about in our 12 and 12. I would have said, hey, I'm doing a good job at my job. But if you scratch the surface, I was not killing it. I was showing up. I was doing what I needed to do. I was running a program. People were getting in. People were getting out. But, was I innovating? Was I really there? So part of my living amend to my work is I've taken on a role which includes more responsibility, which has been really good for me. But it would be absolute. I wouldn't have even been asked if I wasn't working this program, And so, and it involves basically dealing with people. Not my strong suit, You know where my grooves are. So I got a lot of those have the first thought, maybe even the second, but I got to shut it down by the third, and I got to get into the healthy thinking and the recovery, especially working with other people. And, I'm not the only hair trigger person out there. So, I gotta bring, my recovery to every interaction. And I'm just so grateful that I can. This is just my belief. I think that God loves us so much that he gave us this disease. Three times a day he wants to hear from us, minimally, and maybe more, because we have to let that lion out of the cage three times a day. And when I first came, that was so hard for me. So how much time do I have left? None. Zero. I'm out. Okay. I'm so sorry. Okay. We're here because God loves us and he wants to know us. We need his power and the knowledge of his will for us to live the life that he wants us to live. We find what we need in OA. This is our refuge. This is where we're going to find everything we need to live the life that God wants us to live. My first sponsor's husband used to say, folks, the answer to the riddle of life itself is in these rooms. And what a gift we have. So thank you. Keep coming back. Okay, folks, come on back. Oh, sorry. Okay, thank you. My 5'2"-ness needs adjustments. I'm sorry, what is your name? Thank you. Okay, guys, well, I do have a few questions here, so thank you for these. You know, before I launch into these, actually, there was one thing I wanted just to share, and I blew over it. But when I came back, so, you know, I shared how I was eating and not cooking and all that and just going out and buying stuff. And then when I came to program, wow, what a departure I had. So in upstate New York, there's kind of like, it's called Wegmans. It's like a fancy grocery store, kind of like Sendex. So I remember walking into Wegmans, getting a cart. I'm like 35 years old, and I have a list of ingredients and a cart. And I've almost never done that before myself as an adult, because remember, I was just buying stuff and eating. You know, I just never went to the grocery store and, like, was an adult, bought stuff, have it in the refrigerator, prepare it for the next day. So I'm real cognizant of that when people are new, because it was such a lifestyle change for me, you know. I mean, I had just shopping and planning and prepping and all that stuff. I never did it. And remember, I wasn't even eating until 8 p.m., so to eat a breakfast, to eat a lunch, you know, so I got a nutritionist. I had to get a food plan and, you know, kind of set that all in rolling, but that ball in motion and get things rolling. But it took a while for me because it was just so different from what I had been doing. And then early on, too, in my program, I had to commit a bedtime. You know, I kept slipping, and, you know, I'd call my sponsor. Oh, I ate again. She's like, what are you doing? And then I'd explain to her, and she's like, why don't you go to bed? I'm like, oh, well, what? I'm a night owl. Well, because I'm a night owl. You know, that was a thing. Because remember, I'm coming in, I'm argumentative, I'm right. I'm, you know, well, are you going to tell me that I can't have my own body clock rhythms? And, you know, I mean, I have to get up early in the morning, but I still want to stay up till 2 doing nothing. And so, you know, I'm trying to argue for these limitations, you know. But the truth is, the program requires me to make some changes. And so I did, and I'm grateful that I did. So anyway, bedtime, my eating behaviors, no eating in the car, you know. Remember, it used to be the case that, you know, the paying at the pump was new, and sometimes I'd still go in, and I'd walk out with something. Well, in those days, part of my, abstinence was I don't go in. You know, I only go to places where I can pay at the pump. You know, so, I mean, I had to really put up some guardrails for myself, and I'm glad I did. Okay, I got a lot of questions about the 10th step, you know, script and train and all of that. So if you have a folder, my name is Nancy R. I'm on the WeCare list. My email is RiceNancyEllen, all together, @gmail. So, and it's on that sheet. But so if you want to email me, please do so, and then I will forward you the instructions to get on the 10-step train. And so just a little bit more about it, what it is there's a woman, and I don't know if she does this as her service. I mean, it'd be like a part-time job because there are people all over the world. I've been on this, I told you, for like 2.5 years. Is that right? 20? Yeah. So 3.5 years now. Anyway, I've had people from Greece, Ireland, you know. So every day every Thursday I get an email, and it says your new partner for the train starting Sunday is this person. Here's their email, and here's their text information. And they require you to get WhatsApp, which is an international texting app. So anyway, so you can communicate with the person. What time on Sunday you connect. And then each day we you know, say, okay, what? Because my days vary. Some days I have meetings, some days I don't. So we set a time for the next day, and then I call for the first week, they call for the second week, or whatever. And then we each have, and the person who pairs us up and sends the email saying, here's your partner, she has already, in order to get on, to get that email and to get on the list, she has to have walked you through the script. And so the script is, as I said, right from the big book, you know, where was I selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, and frightened? And you do the prayers, and so there's a script. And she walks you through to make sure that you understand what it's going to be like. It's meant to be a 15-minute call. It's 7.5 minutes each. You know, when they're talking, you don't talk. They can ask for feedback. They don't have to. So that's kind of how it works. I launched into it, even though, like I said, I was kind of intimidated at first. I thought, well, I'll try it. I can always get off. In 3.5 years, like for vacation or various reasons, I've gotten off a couple of times, like for 2 weeks. And I kind of liked it, but not enough to not go back. I liked it more. It's kind of that seeking the light. I like the structure now, and I know how much it helps me in my life. So even though I have gotten off a couple of times just because my life, I wasn't going to be in control of my schedule, so I got off. But it's been a game changer, and I would highly recommend it if anybody is interested. What do you do when well-loved and well-meaning people gift you with food, going to the extent for baking me gluten-free for food? So, I think everybody would probably answer this in a different way. I tend not to have stuff in my house that I can't eat, although, as you know, I have an 18-year-old. There is stuff in the house of his that I don't eat. It's in a different place, so I don't look for it. It's not mine, so that's kind of how I've resolved that. If somebody gave me something, somebody who, who is well-loved, what does it say? When a well-loved and well-meaning person, if people give me things, my neighbor does this almost every holiday, and I thank her, and she doesn't know I'm in program, and I usually give it away. I mean, I hate to say it, but I sometimes will throw food away. I mean, I just can't have it around, you know, and if there's nobody to give it to, but there usually is. I take stuff to work. Like, I buy Girl Scout cookies. I buy the Boy Scout popcorn. It all goes to work. You know, I just don't even have it in the house. So that's how I handle things. I mean, you know, I guess it depends on the relationship with the person. If it is a loving relationship and they know that you're in program and you tell them that, and, you know, you could just say, you know. I mean, the other thing is sometimes people don't know what to do. Like, I didn't know any of this stuff that we talk about now about how, you know, recovery. Sometimes people, you know, could use a suggestion to say, oh, you know what, if you wanted to bring something, you could bring fruit. You know, preemptively maybe share with them what your needs are or something like that, you know, if it's an event, so that they don't bring that. Maybe that's their thing and they feel like, oh, I got to bring that. She always wants that, you know. But maybe you could change that. So what techniques do you use to deal with self-righteousness? That's an interesting question. Because I don't know if it's a tech. I mean, I guess I would say the 10th step and the development of humility, you know. And, I mean, that to me is the counter to self-righteousness. But, you know, part of the other thing is just, I know this isn't a great answer. It's like it depends. But it does depend, you know, because self-righteousness for me was born out of that unworthiness. And the only way I can show you that I'm worth anything is by being, I was really good at school. So that was my thing. So I felt like I had to be, you know, the smartest, the fastest, in every place in my life, or I wasn't worthy. Because that was the only thing I thought I had going for myself. So my self-righteousness was really bound up with my worth and my identity, you know. For some people, it's not quite as bound up, but that's, I think, why it has become, you know, such a big character defect of mine. But the technique or the antidote to it, in my opinion, is, you know, and also I think, you know, in some ways, is it just living life? You know, you live long enough and it's like, oh, yeah, I was wrong again. Oh, well. You know, it doesn't sting as much. When I was little, when I was younger, I had to be right. And now it just doesn't matter that much. You know, and remember I was saying about the pause and how I literally could not even comprehend it. The same is true of that phrase, would you rather be right than happy? I literally was like, why can't you be both? You know, I didn't understand, you know? I was like, come on, people. So, you know, so I didn't even get it. And now, not only do I get it, I want to be happy. I don't, you know? And I really can let go of being right. And that's part of one of the, I guess I would say, techniques of getting rid of self-righteousness is just keep coming back and working this program. So anyway, that's what I'll say about that. Share the 10th step script. Is there a special resource that you use? So a lot of these are about the 10th step. I'm sorry, I thought I sorted these better. You mentioned that you didn't become absent until months into coming back. How did you stay motivated to keep coming back while still active in the addiction? Yeah, that's a very good question, because you'll notice, I mean, I did that now this time, fall of 18, I came back and I got absent fall of 19, but I also had long absences. So I don't have a long history of, and I know some people do, they keep coming back even though they are, you know, active in the addiction. And I am always impressed by that. But in that little bit from 18 to 19, I just, I felt the my mother's hand in me coming back, you know, and I felt also like God. I felt a real closeness to God when I came back this time. So that even though I was still picking up, and I wasn't, my binging was lessening. I was already losing weight and stuff. So I was still coming back, but I wasn't, you know, fully absent, I guess you would say. So what kept me coming back was recovery, you know. And I think we can have, I have had recovery even though I was still. I hadn't fully put down the food, and I think that can absolutely happen. So keep coming back no matter what, no matter what, you know. Because once you put down the food, guess what? Life happens. You know, all these things, the same way that we talk about the obsession with the food and all that, it's the same with issues, with people, you know. And I can ruminate, and I can make myself crazy and drive myself back in the food or not. And the only way I cannot do it, though, is with the help of God. I can't do it. I know I can't. I absolutely, 1,000%, it's not coming from Nancy. So I have got to be plugged into my power source. And I'm going to call it a cord. Is that okay? Is that okay? Or should I call it a charger? I don't know. Okay, I'm sorry. Okay. All right, I might go to hell for that one. Sorry, Dill. Okay. This is a question. As an on-off smoker, have you stopped smoking and stayed absent with program? Yeah, I quit smoking, and I gained 15 pounds right away. Years ago, I quit smoking in 1989. So I had come to OA, lost all that weight while I was smoking, and then I subsequently quit smoking. And I stopped in 89 and haven't picked up since. But then it was really clear that food's my primary addiction because everything else is gone, and I'm still. And now I'm really eating because I'm not smoking, I'm not drinking, I'm not doing drugs. Oh my God, it's exhausting. Okay, what is a how meeting? How is a? I guess I think again, if you ask various people, they'll tell you different things. But I think of it as a subset of OA. So OA is, you know, our organization, Overeaters Anonymous, and there are subsets, I guess, of OA, and how is one of those subsets? It stands for honesty, open-mindedness, and willingness, and, you know, a lot of people in how, in my experience, their abstinence includes no sugar, no white flour. Not everybody in how is subscribes to that, but a lot of people do. And they recommend, you know, texting your or sending your food to your sponsor, which I do daily. Maybe I do it 5 days a week. My sponsor's here, so okay. Okay, so okay. Anywho, I'm fairly boring though. I eat kind of the same stuff, but in any case. So yeah, it includes texting your food, doing as much, you know, especially when we come in, we have how questions, doing some daily reading and writing. So it's, and then there is a paragraph that describes what how is, and it just talks about, I mean, and again, like, I didn't know any different, because like in Arizona, Syracuse, and here, I just happened upon how meetings, and again, I'm very grateful, I didn't have to make that choice. But in our literature, it says, we believe that our disease is absolute, and therefore only absolute acceptance of this program will help us to get into recovery. And so, you know, we don't take the steps and stuff as suggestions, but we say they're requirements. So anyway, I think, you know, they just are kind of saying, you know, in order to get it, I need accountability. So I really appreciate the, you know, writing down my food and sending it to someone. I think, you know, OA as a whole, the umbrella of OA as a whole, people do that very differently. Food plans look different and how people manage that looks different. But how is just provides that little more structure, which I really need, you know. Professionally, I'm a teacher, and just like when I was a kid, I loved, you know, unstructured time and unfettered access to food. I mean, I love teaching, but I love summers. And when I was in my 20s, what I loved about it was travel and unstructured time and unfettered access to food, you know. So I need structure. And, you know, sometimes I'm not bringing it all the time. So I need it imposed from the outside, and I appreciate that. So that's how I conceptualize how. But it's probably a good question to ask people throughout the conference because they'll have different views on it. So that is the last question that I'm seeing. So thanks again, everybody. Have a great conference. Okay.